From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and today I am super excited because we're going to be talking about a man who has built something, not about a man, with a man who has built something quite spectacular in our region. And by the way he began his life, I'm assuming that he is just one of those resilient people. He has to be. So we're going to talk about that. He's built this incredible company. It's called Cobex Construction. And you might see them if you're driving down the freeway. They've got billboards all over the place. And they built quite a bit, quite a heck of a business. I am with Vosgen Dalakhanya. How do I
it's a mouthful. Dalakhian.
And you are Armenian.
Correct.
And so we're just talking about you coming from this war-torn area as a child and immigrating to the U.S. Before we get into that, I want the audience to know what a successful guy you are as well. So tell me just like an overview about the company you've built and the size and the growth rate and all that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we've had some business success building Cobex through the years, thanks to a lot of really hardworking people. And we are at 25 million top line across now 6 locations.
Wow.
But of those 6, 2 of them are a little bit more established. We have Central Valley and Idaho. They're about 2.5 years in. 2 of them, I would say they're kind of just now walking, you know, and the other 2 are kind of still at the infancy stage. But Sacramento is our main hub, and we have about 60 employees and a lot of subcontractors.
And you do roofing?
Primarily roofing and exterior. Mostly roofing, and we do exteriors, roofing. Just outside.
Wow.
Residential.
Okay. Unresidential.
Unresidential.
Wow. Incredible company. That's a really nice top line revenue. But if some of your entities are still in their infancy, right, it sounds like there's plenty of room for growth.
Oh, yeah. I call 2025 the great teacher. I mean, we got our butts kicked just with a lot of growing pains, trying to figure out how to make make the company run healthy and grow at the same time. There's been a lot of challenges. I mean, I think just marketing your business is a lot different today versus how it was before. A lot more competition. The consumers are, you know, a little different now. So it's always been a challenge. But I think especially 2025 was particularly challenging. We did grow top line. But, you know, I'd like to see us be a lot more efficient and effective. And I think we've made some good changes, but we can get into it. But, it's all part of the process, though. I mean, I love it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And you're a young guy, you're a family man. So, I mean, it's really impressive that you built such a company at such a young age. But we'll get into family a little bit, if you don't mind. But before we do that, I want to dive a little bit more into the business. I think that that's really interesting that you've had these challenges, especially in 2025, but along the way in building the company. Because I think a lot of people think, oh, you got this $25 million a year company. Life is good. Sounds like what's he sweating? What were the biggest challenges this year? You mentioned marketing, but maybe we can go through the different types of challenges that somebody in your industry is going to face.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes I wonder, like, our business, you know, are we a construction company? Are we a tech company? Are we a marketing or sales company? A little bit of everything. So there's always challenges depending on what the season is. I think last year, particularly, you know, to get in front of a customer takes a lot more effort today than I remember it taking even just starting 8 years ago. So that means, you know, just getting leads, getting in front of customers, okay, just competing for the business. So it's costing a lot more money and going through a lot more competition to get there. So you just having to stay creative, having to look at different ways to, you know, meet people, to be in front of them, to be able to have a chance to even swing at the bat, you know, to get a deal. So that was part of the challenge.
On that, though, you built this brand recognition. Is it predominantly through billboards, or are there other ways that you go about building the brand?
Yeah, so, you know, when I look at billboards or brand building in general, that's kind of what I'm thinking about, just brand recognition, top of mind, consideration. Those are all things that play into just people considering us when they're thinking about getting a roof. Of course, when people see billboards, they may think, hey, you know, you're gonna get all these calls all of a sudden. You know, you're gonna be flooded with people that want your services. That's not quite how billboards work. I mean, they may in some, you know, industries, but at least not in ours. And so it's just more to build some trust with the consumer, brand recognition, and top of mind consideration.
Yeah, and then you have to go, you got to have a marketing plan, direct marketing, I suppose, to actually get the phone to ring or get the leads.
Yep, especially if you're doing that, you want to think about it as like a multi-pronged approach. You know, you got the brand play there, then you have direct marketing or you do some social media. Mm-hmm. So now they may be on their phones, thinking about getting the roof, and they see Kobeck's ad on Facebook, and then they remember seeing us on a billboard. They might have seen our trucks. They might have drove by and saw a yard sign. Mm-hmm. And so all those things kind of help play well together. Standalone, not as effective, but combined effort with maybe some commercial, some TV, some radio, all those things kind of play well together when you combine them.
That's great. So do you feel like you've figured out the formula? And I also kind of wonder, it does... obviously search is in the process of changing in a big way. We don't really use Google the way we used to. We're using ChatGPT and the other LLMs to get our data.
Exactly.
Are you able to sort of tap into things that replace that? I mean, how do you get found online?
That's been a really cool emerging, you know, different strategy now, especially, you know, before you're thinking about maybe going on Google. And even the way Google would rank businesses before were different. They would look at years in business. They would look at other, directories that you may be listed on and just consistency across the board. Today, I feel like even Google looks at things a little differently. It's not, keywords still make a big, you know, play in it, but it's not so much directly like tied to years in businesses. Reviews play a lot, you know, authority plays a lot, how you're mentioned across other trustworthy sources. So those things all play in effect. But like, I think what you mentioned is really interesting about just like people using ChatGPT or search and, you know, like, intelligent search engines like that to be able to answer engines, they call, you know, to actually give you the recommendation, who's the best company and why. And so I think figuring out how to appear in those AI searches is probably a smart move. And so we've been looking at ways to make our website easier for AI to, kind of screen it, what it's looking at. It's not like ChatGPT, for instance, doesn't really play well with Google. They have some restrictions around it. So chat's going to go to like maybe Reddit or other social media. It'll go through other sources and directories. But for example, Gemini and Google, they, you know, it's the same company. So that's going to search better. If you do good on Google, you'll probably do good on a Gemini search. That's their AI version. So even different chat platforms act a little differently right now.
It's amazing. It's changing so fast too. So are you doing social media advertising or just doing organic stuff?
Yeah. So we do a lot of organic social media post, that's just content. You know, we want to get a brand and just people to recognize as far as like the people who they're working with, just build some familiarity there, get some content out. But then we do paid ads, you know, through Facebook. We do paid ads. Yeah. So through Meta, we do paid ads through Google and then some streaming services as well.
Yeah. And I have to imagine in a business like that, there's referrals too. You mentioned yard signs.
Yeah.
Just neighbors telling neighbors, hey, you got a new roof put on, right? That type of thing.
Yeah.
Because I would assume a lot of it's replacement.
Of course, absolutely. I mean, that's still a lot of referrals, a lot of repeats. That continues to be one of the main drivers of our business. People who've worked with us in the past and want other services done, or of course, recommending us to friends and family members. So that's always the best way to still get in front of people. Just do a good job, hopefully get more reviews and referrals and that kind of thing. But that's, if you're growing the company, that's going to only sustain so much of it. So paid ads and media and marketing is such a big part of the rest of it.
Okay.
Especially as you're looking at getting into new locations, because nobody really knows who you are, especially I can brand like, you know, here in Sacramento and people may have recognized us through our marketing. But when you go to a new location, you're pretty much starting from scratch.
Okay. So what was the biggest, as you said, 2025 was a big learning year. What was the biggest takeaway in terms of, let's call it brand and marketing. Did you come up with like a new plan for moving forward in 2026?
I think it's just It was a combination of incentivizing the salespeople to drum up some of their own business, you know, for them to lean into their own efforts of like how to build their pipelines versus just relying on company provided leads, which is kind of, you know, you become a lead junkie as a salesperson. Mm-hmm. You go from one company to the other. But if you teach somebody to harness their own, you know, their own self, generate their own business, mm-hmm. get out there and drum up their own business so they can think of themselves as like, you know, professionals in that sense, being outside sales reps, that helps a lot, especially going into new territories. But I think just working with the, you know, even the better lead aggregators, some, you know, you buy some leads and mm-hmm. some are better than others, having good ways to track them. So I can't say there's been like one pivotal, you know, move that's made a big difference. I think it was just a combination of trying to get a little bit better at each of them.
How difficult is it to find a good salesperson, and how do you find a good salesperson?
Man, I wish it was like a little easier to predict. Sometimes it's not very mm-hmm. easy to predict who's going to be good and who's not. Like I've been wrong, you know. Like there's been times where I've talked to guys where I'm like, I don't know, man, I don't know if they're going to cut it, you know, and they've surprised me. And other times I thought for sure they're going to knock it out of the ballpark and they just kind of, you know, flopped. And so I think it's just the you know, are they coachable, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if they're coachable, that's going to go a long way. Do they like the job? Can they tolerate kind of the variability of having a commission only position? Mm-hmm. You know, that's also going to be a type of personality trait that they're going to have, whether they can stomach that up and down. And then lastly, you know, are they likable? Honestly, mm-hmm. that goes a long way, because people buy from who they like. And so if they check those boxes and they meet our core values, which is kind of our filtering system, I think we can make anybody work. And in fact, we have a lot of our best guys came from like non-sales, non-construction experience backgrounds. And they were a clean slate, and they're very coachable and adaptable. And we were able to build them from scratch.
Oh, that's great. And you create probably somebody who has more loyalty too when they... wow, these people taught me how to do it. I feel loyal, and you know, they're likely to stick around.
Yeah, true that. And then also just they learned the right way from the beginning. They don't bring in some maybe bad habits and mm-hmm. stuff. They're clean slate. So it's also more scalable, right? Because if you're going into different locations, or if you're trying to grow your team, you don't need to rely on guys with have industry experience. You can bring somebody fresh and just train them, and that, you know, that's, it's a better model long term if you think about it.
Yeah for sure. Okay, any other challenges that you would call significant in 2025 that you had to address?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've learned sometimes less is more. Sometimes you're thinking, okay, I'm gonna have all in-house crews. We're going to deck them out with like the latest and greatest. And, you know, then you go into, obviously you want to offer everyone good benefits. You know, then you have overtime and everything, all the good stuff that comes along with being a W-2 employee. But if you don't have a way to pay people based on performance and quality and measure it and manage it, it becomes a lot, mm-hmm. right? You end up having, now you have to have like a crew manager, then if you decide you want to have inventory like in your warehouse versus buying it directly from supplier, now you have an inventory manager, then you get to keep track of inventory. So then every time you add an employee or a role or a process, it changes the complexity by order of magnitude. It's not mm-hmm. just a simple, you know, like, hey, it's just a little bit more complicated, but now there's so many more people to manage. And so what I found is just, you know, the chain of command. So I had this idea originally. I'm thinking about like big companies. What do they have? Okay, well, they have these superintendents, they have project managers, they have operations managers, production managers, the COOs. And so what happens in theory, it sounds good. It's just like kind of military train mm-hmm. of command. But in reality, in a business like ours, I think simple is better. I think keeping an organization more flat is more effective, empowering people to make decisions on the ground level and also to own those decisions. And there's less fingers to point, and there's you shorten the feedback loop, so to speak, right? So it's not, hey, I had to deal with, this is a complaint that I was getting. So I'd get a customer saying, you know, everything was great, but I just, there was too many people involved. I didn't know who to go to or something like that. You know, mm-hmm. they'd mention something like that where it was just like, man, that's frustrating, because you try to offer them this experience. But for them, it's like, well, I've had to talk to five or six different people yeah, yeah. to get my roof done. And so it's like, And for us, maybe it may seem like, hey, that's great. We have this, you know, chain of command and it's effective. But for the customer experience, it's just too many people involved.
How do you do that? So I own a company. I've got a construction company, but I also have a company that is kind of like a construction company. We do security cameras in casinos.
Yeah.
So they do large projects. And so the projects can have a lot of complexity. They can take, you know, months to get done. And so then we've sort of dealt with that same thing is like, right. Okay, who's in charge of the project? You have your salesperson, then you have a project manager, and then you have superintendents and so on that oversee all this stuff. And then you're subcontracting part of it out. So it's an interesting question on how to do that so the customer gets the best possible experience.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of how I'm retraining myself to think. And I've known this, but it's just, you know, it takes practice, like thinking from the customer experience, like what do they want? You know, mm-hmm. what's that going to look like? And when I realize when there's multiple people responsible, then no one's responsible, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what happens.
Somebody say one throat to choke.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's just like, it just becomes a, you know, hey, like, especially you've sent emails and sometimes you like, you'll CC like three or four people mm-hmm. thinking, hey, I want everyone's visibility on this, but everyone else is waiting for somebody else to respond.
Right.
Right. And so it just doesn't get done versus like, no, you know, you go and there's one person. And so I think it's just like, hey, can this person handle it, you know, or do they need to include anybody else in it, right? Sometimes we feel like we need other people to get involved to make a decision, but really we just need to make a decision and move, you know.
So empower somebody to get the job done.
Empower somebody to get the job done, make a quick decision, move fast. You know, time is money. And so when, you know, a conflict delayed is a conflict multiplied, right? So like, especially problems that like, you know, could be solved quickly if you're waiting to get all, I mean, sometimes you have to wait to get all the information, right? But it's not going to be perfect. And, you know, the best time to take care of an issue is right away. You know, you delay, it's like AR, you know, the longer your accounts receivables goes, the harder it is to collect that money. But, you know, if you're able to just figure out a solution right away, collect it, move on, you're going to save time, money, energy, effort. And so it's just all those things just factoring in like, hey, make a quick decision. You know, then if you made a mistake, go back and figure out what that was and then try to, you know, change something down the road. Cause I think on to the third thing I would mention was just like, you're moving so fast. Well, do you have time to go back and review, do a case study? So for instance, like I noticed, we're paying more in sales commissions, right? Which is great because, hey, that means everyone's making more money. But then I'm looking at my gross profit. I'm like, hey, but why is my gross profit less if I'm paying more in sales commissions? It doesn't make sense because it's proportionate to the gross profit, which tells me that there's a variance of like where I'm bidding the job to where it's actually landing. So where's this gap, you know? And so I think that was like a big problem looking to solve that. Like, hey, are we doing enough case studies after the jobs? Where did the mistakes mm-hmm. happen? Was it on the bidding side? Was there a production delay? Where did that delay happen? And so it's like, yes, you're moving quickly and you have all this revenue and coming in, you're producing jobs, but like ultimately what's the bottom line looking like? Is that increasing? If not, where are we off? And so I think going into 2026, it's a lot more like, you know, a consistent process, closed job reviews, making that kind of more routine, creating that cadence of like, and also it's like, well, who's responsible for it, right? Because again, it was, is also the incentives, like how people are paid, right? If they're not feeling it, they're maybe not going to take as much ownership, but it affects their pocket. Like if it's sales related and affects mm-hmm. their pocket, or production doesn't get their bonuses because they're not meeting their budgets. Now different people are feeling it. Now they're a little bit more incentivized. Not to say that you shouldn't have like people that are just honest to begin with, but it's kind of human nature, right? And I think incentives of how people are paid makes a big difference in just driving that cadence and that culture of checking in on that. So that was, I would say that's like the third thing is just closed job reviews and mm-hmm. creating a process for, you know, the case studies of what went wrong and what went right too. Like, why did we do so well on this job? What went right?
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about that. So from a job that goes, a job that goes well, give me like a run-of-the-mill job. Is it a re-roof or do you do new construction?
Almost all re-roofs.
Okay.
Sometimes we'll do new constructions, but it's really not our forte. Mostly re-roofs. And a job that goes well is just right off the back. It's like our standard, you know, process, a standard roofing job, maybe like, you know, 3,000 square foot of roofs, walkable shingles, you know, using our Owens Corning, you know, we're platinum with them. So we have, you know, we like their product because we get offered the best warranties through mm-hmm. them. So there we have things dialed in pretty good. It's very hard to miss things if you're looking at a standard roof. I think those jobs, they're going to be pretty good.
You know, okay, so the customer experience, I haven't had a re-roof while I've been living there. Although my son's house, which we're dealing with right now, he's got like a flat roof in one area with a like a area where you can kind of like a little outdoor entertaining that's above the former garage, and it leaked. And getting the right, they didn't put the right sealant on top, and it was flat. So obviously got into the sheetrock and all that stuff. It was a pain in the butt. So he's still dealing with that. Mm-hmm. It's almost done. They've been dealing with the construction for months because of the amount of work it took to tear it out, and then a limited number of people can do the work. So it's been, I think, a little bit disruptive to their family.
Yeah.
So here's my question. You're re-roofing, and there's a tear-off, and then you got to put the new stuff on there. How disruptive in a good situation is it for a family, and like in a bad situation, how disruptive is it?
Well, you try to avoid the bad situations by not tearing roofs off without like a solid game plan.
Okay, you got your stuff on.
You got to have, first of all, you know, you want, especially with the rainy season, you want to make sure you can get in and get out pretty quickly. I'll give you a bad example of how disruptive it can get. So we had a situation, we tore a roof off, and once we tore it off, there was structural damage underneath, right? This was unforeseen. So it's going to be a large change order. Engineers have to get involved. We have to get that. We can't just like, you know, a couple 2x4s and we're good to go. Engineers have to get involved. Well, homeowner says, I can't afford it. And so, you know, we're like, okay, well, you know, we cannot like re-roof this like legally because we have to bring everything to code. So, and it's a big job. It's not like something we could just patch up together real quick and, you know, put it and it's going to be fine. So I'm like, okay, we'll tarp it. And we'll try to figure out ways to see maybe we can get financing for you guys or look at different options. And so during this time, we had terrible storms, like wind storms, and the tarp blew off two or three times, went out there two or three times retarping it, which cost us time and money. But like, what are we going to do? We're not going to leave it exposed. Long story short, there was a leak issue and there was some damage, and then insurance had to get involved, and it became, you know, a longer process than it needed to. But it was just, some of them is just really hard to avoid, right? And it was pretty disruptive for everybody, and for us, it didn't go well because we had to, you know, help mitigate a lot of that along the way.
But, and I would imagine that the homeowners are worried about things like mold.
That was a big concern, right? Mold and all that, and of course, when that happens, obviously we you know, we want to go dry it in, do our part. And sometimes it's just like, it's the cost of doing business, you know, like you're spending money to go dry it in, get a mitigation company out there. You're like, but it wasn't our fault, you know, because we did our job, you know, but what are you going to do? Like you kind of have to try to mitigate that best you can because you were there on the job, even though like a couple months went by and, you know, like it just, and this was when it was fall, then going into winter. So just have to kind of plan around as much as you can and try to come up with the game plan quickly and as you know, best you can. I think in that situation, what I would have done different is instead of tearing the whole roof off, I would have just left part of it exposed and finished the rest of it and said, okay, if this is just the garage, right, let's just finish the rest of it and we'll just tarp the garage off and we'll just fix that later. And at least the rest of it would have been somewhat covered. So that was a big, you know, learning opportunity for us. But ideally, you're going to have your roof torn off in one day. All the woodwork is going to be done, hopefully same day or next day. And the day after, we're going to finish installing the shingles if it's a standard size. So you're looking at 3 days max for a standard roof.
Oh, wow. Okay. So it's pretty quick.
Pretty non-invasive.
Pretty painless. Yeah.
Pretty painless for the most
part. That's cool. Yeah. Good to know. I've got some rental properties. Hopefully they all have decent roofs right now. How much does it cost you? 3,000 square foot house with the standard roof, how much is that?
Yeah, I think ballpark about $25,000 to $30,000, depending on the complexity of the roof. So I think that's probably a pretty safe ballpark.
Okay. 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 So in terms of the growing the business. You started it. Talk to me about how you started it. You started it from scratch. I take it you were, I guess you were in construction. You knew about that kind of stuff and you said, hey, I'm going out, hang my own shingle. How'd that work?
No, actually, on the contrary, I just was in a completely different industry. I was in health and fitness, out of a personal training business. I graduated from Sac State with a Kines major. I was going to go be a physician's assistant or a physical therapist or something. I actually was in, like, again, my master's degree, just started my first 2 weeks. And then something just kind of hit me. It was just like a combination of my girlfriend, my wife now, and a few other people that were just like, you know, just they just knew, like, the school thing wasn't really like, I was just doing it just to check the box. And so they challenged me a bit and I was like, you know, they're probably right. So,
except where you can go big.
I know, right? So, I mean, I'm not against school at all, but I was always a little bit entrepreneurial. So anyways, long story short, I decided just to kind of test out this, you know, build my personal training business. And I did that pretty well, except I hit like a plateau and I either was going to build out a gym and hire a bunch of trainers and do that. Then I figured, you know, like, I want to get into a different industry, something that's going to be a little bit more scalable. I liked construction. I liked, you know, the real estate. So I just, one thing led to another, and I met, you know, two friends from church, and they were just starting a construction company together. They haven't formed their entity yet, but they wanted to do it. And I just got in the mix and, you know, decided to take on the sales and marketing side with them. Mm-hmm. And so we had a friend, a mutual friend of my partner, had a friend in San Diego that just started his home improvement business. And they allowed us to go and shadow them for a couple of days. And then I think once we got the concept, decided to come and just try it out here and bought some leads and
nice.
Kind of became a one-stop, you know, like, we did a little bit of everything, like door knocking and calling the leads, going to the appointment, giving it to a subcontractor, managing the job. And then that kind of turned into a just general construction services company, which we grew pretty fast. I think we did like 4 million in our first like 18 months, which was really good for just a startup. And then we grew it to about 8 million and it got really complicated because we were doing all the trades. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is like right around COVID. Then we're like, maybe we should start narrowing down these trades and make it a little bit more scalable, especially if we're trying to train sales guys and build this up. So we decided to kind of stop doing interiors and focus on the exteriors. And that's kind of where we really leaned into the roofing side more.
Okay. So you had business partners mm-hmm. and they had construction background at some level.
Yeah. They did some, they built some houses for themselves. I did some flips with my dad and, you know, we always worked on our house growing up. So, we never like were in construction doing labor ourselves, but mm-hmm. we were around it. And so we were familiar with it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the extent of our
construction experience. That's kind of cool. That's a kind of a cool story of just like, hey, let's figure something out and, going door to door. And look, so what's the longer term vision for the company? You guys are growing. It's like you guys have growth mindset.
Yeah, no, the growth mindset is definitely there. I think long term, it's like, can we create a platform for home services? Mm. Right now, it would be still mostly roofing and exteriors. But I think the bigger vision is like, can we create a great platform for home services, a trusted brand, and just grow to different locations and territories and scale it? Building it on technology, building it on, you know, just great customer service. And I think that's just a really fun project to work on. Something that really inspires me, like, to think and grow and challenge myself, you know, to find the right people to grow alongside with. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be create a platform.
I'm not sure if you and I have talked about this in the past. Did you consider franchising at one point, or is that kind of like because I've seen other, let's call it construction companies that have done it through franchising. Mm-hmm. They built a great brand and that kind of thing. And then they, you know, send the leads back to their,
yeah,
you know.
So that's great. I mean, I thought about it. I looked into it. It's, first of all, it's very expensive to franchise, legal work, paperwork and everything. Also, there's pros and cons. I think there's trade-offs, like in all things. One of the trade-offs is you lose a little bit of control in like the reputation and the brand. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're bringing on franchisees and you can regulate it to a degree, but it's the liability and stuff is still there. I think the concept of it, we wanted to take and apply, like, in what does a good franchise look like? Well, they, you know, it's a brand, it's the technology that it sits on, it's the relationships, maybe the buying power that they have with suppliers, marketing partners. So mm-hmm. it's like, can we take that and do greenfields, right? Mm-hmm. And what do we really need to get a greenfield or like a new location going, you know? And so taking that mindset of like building it like a franchise without necessarily selling them like franchises is kind of the mindset I'm in right now, is just what is that, what is a CRM, you know, what's a good CRM to help build on, you know, how can we build the marketing channels the way we need to, how do we get the buying power with the suppliers and all the back end rebates and different things we can negotiate so that when we set up a new location, it's going to be successful. But I think right now it's more just focused on just corporate, you know, single owner and multiple locations with GMs and profit share models.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. So I want to go back to something we talked about at the beginning briefly. And you came from Armenia, which was a war-torn area. And you came here when you were 3 years old. Talk to me about where you lived at the time, what you were going through, and then what your family was going through. And then how you got here, what happened?
Yeah, no, I mean, so we, in Armenia, we lived in a remote village. It's known as like the Caucasian Mountains, you know, the Caucasus areas, you know, where all the UFC fighters are from now, that all, you know,
is that right?
Like all the UFC champions, you know, like from Armenia and Georgia and Dagestan and that area.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
okay.
That's the area that I'm born. So the Caucasus Mountains and that part of the world. So we,
in Armenia, it's former Soviet Union.
Yeah.
You have a good relationship with Russia, right? The country does.
Yeah.
Currently.
Well, that was the main ally, right? Russia was like the main ally, former Soviet Union country, a lot of Soviet influence in culture. Everyone grew up speaking Russian because that was like the language that was taught in schools. So like my parents, everyone speaks fluent Russian. I don't, because I grew up in America. I mean, I speak some Russian because of my community, that community I'm in, but like not enough.
Did your family have, were they forced to leave, like evacuate type thing?
Yeah. So what happened when that, you know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, like, we were talking about a little bit before the show. Everyone kind of fought, like Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, these countries that are in this region, they're fighting for their identity and their, you know, their territory now. And so there's some disputed territories between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And I was in one of those territories. My family was, you know, we had about 150,000 people just in that general area. Our village was an area that was lost during that war, that conflict. So essentially what happened is we were given an ultimatum, right? Like they, at that time, that country had a lot more influence and money and support, you know? And so they took that part of the land, which I was born in, and now, you know, they took it over completely. We won some territory during that dispute, but not the part that, you know, my family was born in. But eventually, we immigrated here as refugees.
Was your family, like your dad or maybe, other family members, were they involved, physically in the conflict?
Yeah. So, there were several that were, you know, it was kind of, there were a lot of people that came and, you know, fought, from Armenia proper and from the villages that we were from too, like that were in this disputed territory. My dad and a few of my uncles and stuff, they did get, you know, drafted into it, and they were able to get out because it was kind of a losing battle at that time. Like there was really not much that they were going to be able to do going up against kind of like all this military as a Soviet country, you were not allowed to, you know, have weapons and defend you weren't allowed to carry anything. So there was really, but they hired mercenaries, right? And then finally, when we got some support, it was a little bit later, but then we were able to defend and take more land back. But yeah, at that time, a lot of people got pulled into that conflict.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have to imagine how much that, you know, shaped you. You grew up as a little kid, listening to your family talk about this, is, you know, surviving it basically.
Yeah. Yeah. No, really. I mean, it does because, you know, you grow up kind of hearing these stories and you have some faint memories. I mean, I was young, but I think you remember how you felt in that moment. You remember the fear. You remember the sadness, you know, of the people losing kind of their home and their land that they've had. And it was really ancient land. Like we're talking, I think they just did like a recent study in this area, in this region, that there's been people that have been there for like centuries, like that just haven't left that area. And so there's that feeling of you just like your identity and everything, right? That's tied into those lands. And so I think my parents, my grandparents, especially, they felt it. But I will say, though, they were very, very grateful to be in this country. They loved America. I mean, to them, it was like, you know, they thought they were in heaven. They really
Why
did
you choose America?
Like, well, it was... Was there not a lot of choices?
No.
Originally, it was going to be Russia because half my family moved to Russia and they went to Moscow and whatnot. We came here for religious... because of our church, at that time we were like, we're Eastern or Armenian Apostolic, you know, it's like a, more of like similar to Orthodox. But there was like a church move. There's like a movement that happened in that time, like through evangelists that came from America. And so there was like churches that were planted and they're here in America. And so some people from that, from my village, like my uncle and stuff, they started kind of going where that church was going. And so there was a church community here in Sacramento. And I think it started with like the Slavic community first. Mm-hmm. Like Bethany is this big church. A lot of people came from that church, but there was like a movement in the kind of the Slavic communities and Armenians. The missionaries came from that region. And so I think that was a big influence of why we ended up here, because I think we would have ended up in Russia otherwise, and we would have been in Moscow right now.
Yeah.
But that was eventually, so America was like the kind of just started with a small community. And then it grew more now other people, not because of religion, but because there's a community here. They're like, hey, there's Armenians in Sacramento or Fresno. And then they'll come here because there's other Armenians here. But really, I mean, when we look at Armenia as a country, there's only 3 million Armenians in the country of Armenia and maybe another 10 million worldwide. So it's a very small, you know, group of people. So they like to be around where other Armenians are. Mm-hmm. So that happened to be, now it's Sacramento, but LA is the biggest community and Fresno has a decent size community as well.
I always think about the people that love America the most or appreciate America. When I talk to people who have come here from a rougher situation, there's a real appreciation for, you know, free markets and the things that happen in America that maybe might not happen in a Soviet Union type of situation, Russia or Eastern European country. What are your parents? What's their feeling about America? Do they have a love for America and the opportunity, or how do you describe that?
Yeah, no, they love the country because the opportunity that you have here. Because when you're born here, like, you don't really know what you have because you have nothing to compare it to.
Yeah.
Right. Like there is no, you didn't grow up in a country where you're restricted on what you can say, your freedom of speech, you know, your freedom to protect yourself. You're either like ruled by an oligarchy, a dictatorship, or, you know, just kind of like a pseudo democracy of some sort. Right. So you come to this country where, you know, it's you're taking your naturalization test to become a citizen, and you learn about your rights, you learn about the freedom, and you learn about, you know, kind of the founding fathers and the history. And I think once you're captivated by this American dream, and what is that really? It's like this, the opportunity, right, to create your own life, right, to have freedom, to, you know, carve your own path, right? And it's celebrated here. So like in America, if somebody has a successful story, like look, your show, you're successful because you interview people that are entrepreneurial, and people love that. People love rooting for the entrepreneur. That's somebody that made it. And that's something that's celebrated in this country. It's not like that in other countries. In fact, you know, most, it's like you have really high wealthy upper class, and then you have kind of everybody else that's barely making it. There really is no middle class in most countries, right? So most people don't have those opportunities. They're either you know, maybe through corruption or family influence or some other way they got to the top, or they're just barely making it, right? So now you have this country where anybody can make it into the middle class, essentially. I know not everyone may have the exact same opportunity, but you have a fighting chance. Mm-hmm. And so I think them realizing that is really what makes them love this country more and appreciate what this country can do. And for me, I think that's what really helped shape my views of this, just our my opportunity too, because I was lucky enough to see a little bit of that and be aware enough to know that. Because when we moved here, we were very, like, I mean, we didn't have anything.
You had nothing.
Yeah. So I got to see kind of my, through
So through your all dad that. And I assume your mother had to just work like crazy to...
Yeah. I mean, they loved
put food on the table.
Yes, but they loved working. My dad loved to work.
Did he? What's he do for a living? Is he?
He's a painter. Okay. He paints houses, and so he's semi retired now. Mm-hmm. So, but
you control your outcomes.
You control, he had a couple guys, small crews, and just really just word of mouth. That's kind awesome. Of like. And it is, and my mom, she the alterations and baking cakes and different things like that. So like I started working when I was like 14.
And I hear about that. I see it too. Yeah. The immigrant work ethic and things like that. It's obviously strong, and you guys make some of the best entrepreneurs for America. You make America great. I mean,
there's a caveat that I will say, because some immigrants, some people, they come to the country and then they have help, right? Have government assistance. And it's great because it gives somebody an opportunity to just at least put food on their table until they get on their feet, right? But some people just, they're not able to get out of that. Right. Yeah. Because they're used to getting a handout from the government for some time. And then now they can't show that they're earning money, because what if their Medi-Cal gets taken away? What if their food stamps and get taken away? So they just kind of stay on the system. Wow. And that's really sad. You know,
you see that in the Slavic community, or do you see that in other communities?
No, I can't really, not too much in the Slavic community.
Guys are the hardest working guys on the construction sites, or wherever I see them around. It's like, man, a lot of driven people
I think, in your community. No, I think there's too much ambition there in some of our communities to like really stay there. I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on it, but I don't think in the Slavic community I see much of that, and much of it
probably because strength of family and religion and things like that.
I think so. I think it's just kind of like, you have a little bit of, you have some pride, you want to give back, you want to contribute. Mm-hmm. But I have seen the other side of it, where you just kind of get stuck.
Yeah.
And that's also,
and it could happen to anybody realistically, if you get used to somebody giving you something, and then you don't have to work for it. It's pretty easy just to get there, and next thing you know, you've been doing that for a long time, and it becomes a habit, becomes a way of life. So even it happens in the way we raise our children. You have three little kids, and you're a very successful person. How do I make sure they have drive, so that they don't feel like they've had everything handed to them as children, even, because it can stay with you into adulthood.
Yeah, I know. It's like that saying. It's like, first, it's this feeling, and you won't, how do you raise your kids in such a way that they don't feel like entitled to things, right? So, and just for most people, like sometimes you'll do somebody a favor, they'll be very grateful at first, and you'll do it again, and they'll be appreciative. After so many times, they start expecting it, and then maybe they'll start demanding it. It's just human nature, right? So how do you make sure that you don't get stuck in that, or get trapped into that, like, hey, somebody owes me something mentality, right? And so it's just, I think for me and my wife and I raising our kids, it's, just teaching them, like, hey, no, there's work you have to put in if you want something, and that you make it a little challenging too, and just not giving things just too easily.
Yeah. My wife, we have two kids. They're older now. We're kind of working with the grandkids, that seven grandkids that are older than, most of them are older than your kids. But it's an interesting thing to how much you want to provide, open doors for people and things like that. It's an interesting thing. But I think most of that, happens in those formative early years. You know, you got what, 2, 4, and 6 year olds, something like that?
4, 6, and 8.
4, 6, and 8. Mm-hmm. In those years, you're learning, I think you mentioned it, through your parents' example or through maybe some other example that's close in the family, could be a grandparent or something. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I feel like I learned it from, that's how I got it from my parents. They were hard workers. But sports.
Yeah.
You know, you were into fitness. You mentioned your kids were into fitness. My kids learned a lot of their work ethic by, you know, competing on the athletic field and maybe not being they didn't have all the talent in the world. So you got to work harder and all those kind of things.
Sometimes that's the best, you know, like when you don't have that much talent and you got to work really hard because it teaches you discipline. I was never like super talented in any one particular sport. You know, my cousins and my friends, like some very really talented guy, athletic guys and stuff. So I had to compete with them. Mm-hmm. And so I had to like just work my butt off and, you know, because they didn't come easy for me. Right. But I look back and I'm like, hey, that was actually good because I had more grit, I had a little bit more, put more work in and stuff. And so I think sports are great because they teach you discipline, following instructions, routines and hard work and stuff. And so I think it could have went either way. If I was a little bit more talented or athletic, I would have went into sports mm-hmm. and did that instead of working at 14. But either way, like it still teaches you. And that's why my wife and I love to get our kids involved in as many different things as we can. Keep them busy, like because just like you said, like the formative years, you know, from like 4 to 2 until like 7 years old, where they're just shaping who they are and a lot of their programming. We're trying to be mindful of that right now, like whatever. You know, they're going to learn in this first 7 years of their life, that's pretty much going to shape most of their life. And so how can we give them the best tools we can now so that they can have, you know, success as they're getting older?
Yeah. You know, thinking about values, you mentioned, you know, your company's got its core values. Your family, I'm sure, has their core values. I don't know if they're identified. Work ethic is huge. I can already tell that. What other values do you feel like for your life, your family, and your business are like front and center stuff that you just fall back on?
Yeah, I mean, I think being a good steward is one of them, right? Like, so I think we're, you know, God's given us a responsibility, right? Everyone according to their talents. And so I think there's going to be a ask at the end. What did you do with the responsibility, the talents, mm-hmm. and the gifts that you mm-hmm. were given? And so I think there's like that and that core responsibility of like, hey, I have to steward what I've been given well. And that's for family and that's for business as well. I think the desire to learn and grow, to get better, it's a commitment really. You know, how am I going to improve and not rest on the status quo? How am I going to get better? And at the end, I think it comes down to just relationships and just loving people, right? You know, it's just we're creatures of where we need each other. We need relationships and want strong relationships. What does that community relationship look like? What does the relationship between employer and employee look like with the customer and stuff? And so just building strong relationships, those would be like the top three that I would say cross over well between family values and work values.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's sort of a common belief or saying that goes something like you become a lot like the people that you spend the most time around. I don't know, something like that. And I know some of your personal friends that are just the most quality people. So I have to imagine that the decision on who you're going to spend your time with, you've got to be sort of careful with that, right? Mm. Because you want to be around people that are going to have a good influence on you, on your family, on your business, instead of being around the people or in the environment that is not going to make you better, grow, you know, tap into that desire to grow.
Yeah, no, that's so good. I mean, you're a prime example of this, just surrounding yourself with just so many, like everyone in the community knows you. You have such a good reputation. And like when your name comes up, you know, it's just, you know, you really built a strong community around you and just, you know, by doing the work that you're doing and surrounding yourself with the kind of people that you have surrounded yourself with. And I think I've made the mistakes of kind of just growing up as like a teenager, just surrounding myself with the wrong group. And I saw kind of like this clear, almost like this clear timeline of like, there's two ways that my life can go. And I almost was at this crossroad and I had to make a decision. And it was when I was 18 because I liked to really enjoy my youth and my high school days. And so I was always curious, and that curiosity is good, but it also can be bad. Yeah. And so I think I saw clearly that, hey, I'm not on the right path when I was in high school. And I saw that, hey, if I continue, this was probably like sophomore, junior year, if I continue this path, it's not going to go well for me because of just the people that I'm surrounded with. And so I think at 18, and this is a hard decision for any 18-year-old to make, well, I just isolated myself for about half a year, and I probably had like one friend, because everyone else, I felt like it was just a slippery slope of me getting back to those, you know, bad habits. So I think that decision had to happen a couple times where I had to just regroup and just decide, mm-hmm. who do I want to surround myself with? And really, it does make the biggest difference. And even as kids, they say, you know, more is caught than taught, mm-hmm. because you learn through kind of osmosis and the people that you're around with. So I'm glad to say today, you know, like in the last decade after I've been married and, you know, for the last 10 years, just the people that I've surrounded myself, I'm just incredibly privileged. Like the church I'm at, you know, just being so close to the...
What church you go to?
I go to Genesis Church.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I love Pastor Mike and Pastor Serge, and they're entrepreneurial themselves. Nice. And just, it's a young church, and just, you know, just really good values and everything. But yeah, I'm very blessed, you know, to have really good people in my around me.
Yeah. Okay, so just last question. Sure. Is there anything I didn't ask you that we should have got out here, or any words of wisdom for our audience?
Man, I wish I had some time to ask you questions. But hopefully we do this again, and maybe I can ask you some questions. I feel like I have so much to learn from you. I think we covered a lot, you know, and just really it all comes down to just making an impact, being a force for good, whatever that looks like. Things can go in any direction. I try not to make my identity Cobex, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. I'm very proud of the people that built Cobex alongside with me and what they've done. I'm impressed by what we've built so far. But at the end of the day, I like to remind myself, like, you know, this is not who I am, right? This is just kind of like a task that God gave me at this time, and I will try mm-hmm. to do the best I can, and hopefully I learned, and hopefully I'll be better because of it. But I just want to leave it with that. It's just like, you know, that your identity, my identity, it's something deeper and something richer than just kind of like what we do or the mm-hmm. brand that we built. And so if I can leave it with one thing, I'll leave it there.
I love it. All right. Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it, Vaz. And congratulations on your success and your rise to building this incredible company. And here's to you having much, much more success.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.